Dear Shopomaniacs, you are listening to another episode of the Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Pointing Pear. Rupert with me is Chris X-Wing Coyer. Hey, Chris, how are you doing today?
Chris the Candidate Coyer. Very special show today, kind of in our series of people that make cool, interesting apps for somewhat niche communities. We have a guest on here, Mr. Sven. How you doing?
I'm doing good.
Sven Codes.
I feel like I need a peppy intro as well, and I don't have one.
Unfortunately, the remaining ones are kind of not safe for work, like naked and single, and so I apologize.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, I ran out of good material, so
I have a feeling Sven's gonna have a lot to say in this episode, which I can't wait to hear. Some stories that I haven't heard about, some niche stuff that I'm very excited to hear about. But just let me tee it up for everybody. It was actually kind of like early pandemic. There's a kind of a famous internet blog from Mr. Jason Kotke, kotke.org, and he links up all kinds of interesting things. And I remember the post. He said he was cruising YouTube and found a YouTube video called The Miracle Sudoku. And I even clicked onto it now. It has some 4 million views or something. And he was just captivated by, you know, some British guy kind of slowly, I'm sure fast by some degrees, but it feels like, you know, he thinks out the logic and talks about what he's thinking, solving a Sudoku puzzle that only had two, what I now know to be called as given digits in a puzzle. And it really is fun to watch because the fella in it is rather charming in a nerdy kind of way. And it's just fun to watch somebody's brain work, I guess. It's just kind of an interesting thing. And I really enjoyed it. And somehow since that day, now many years ago, I smashed that subscribe button on YouTube. And God, if I can't go a day without watching one of those guys solve a puzzle. It's just very satisfying to me in some way. I've become kind of a fan. The show is called Cracking the Cryptic. And in the show, every single episode, for the most part, unless they're doing something weird, like playing some different video game or something, if they're doing a Sudoku puzzle, it's on a piece of software that's very custom built to the logic and idea of solving a Sudoku puzzle, and particularly variant Sudoku, meaning it's not just a grid of numbers, which traditional Sudoku is, although I'm sure the app works great for that. But there tends to be additional stuff. There's stuff called cages, which are like dotted lines in there with numbers. Sometimes there's numbers outside the grid. Sometimes there's little shapes and things inside the grid that represent different rule sets. These type of variant Sudokus, it seems like, oh, it's going to make Sudoku even harder? No, thanks. It doesn't necessarily. It makes it more interesting to me. It makes each puzzle kind of a journey of what it's going to be. So in the videos, they kind of have to cover what the rule set is for that particular puzzle to the point where kind of everybody watching understands it, and then they get into solving it. But they really need a piece of software to be able to do this. And I don't know where this came from, but Sven, today on the show, you built that piece of software, and I just can't wait to hear the story of how that came to be.
Actually, I think that particular video was not running on my software yet, because I wouldn't be surprised if that was also the video that I first saw of them. I'm not 100%, I should really go back to it. But it was around that time that I came across them, and probably in a similar way as you guys. And I don't know. I have a weird ear for this sort of thing. And I guess just in between the lines, I kept hearing them complain about things in the software or announcing things would come. And then I noticed, but they've been announcing that for a while and it still hasn't come. And so eventually, you know, when I see a thing that does 98% of what you want it to do, but not the extra 2%, I always feel compelled to make it do those extra 2%. So actually, I sent him a message on Twitter and said, hey, you know, if you're interested, I could do the thing and add the thing that you want, right? And Simon responded. He's like, oh, that would be great. So I think I put a prototype together over the weekend, and it's pretty much the one I've sent you in CodePen. And it was basically just a clone of the existing software that we're using, which was originally built by a fella called Sam. And I think what had happened at the time, you know, he just wasn't around to do the things that they were waiting for. And at the time, it was sort of the beginning of COVID, and I was in a work from home situation at the JavaScript game studio I was working at, but they were actually winding down their offices in the country where I'm stationed. And so I kind of, every weekend, I was sort of working on SudokuPad. And within a couple of weeks, I basically had it far enough along to say, hey, you know, Simon, you guys can use it. And it does this extra thing. I don't even remember what the original sort of extra feature that it did.
Oh, you don't even remember what the feature was? Hilarious.
Yeah, I don't remember now. Yeah.
A lot of features, we'll say.
Yeah, if you compare it to the original software, yes, of course. Like, they wouldn't be able to go back to it now. They got used to things, you know, certain ways of doing things. But it was interesting because it was completely, you know, reverse engineered, just looking at the JavaScript, trying to figure it out. It was initially just pulling, you know, the data was just, you know, you hit an ID and it spat out this base64 encoded bit of data, you know, and I just pulled it off their, like, off their Firebase server, basically, you know. Mm-hmm. And just reverse engineered the format of these puzzles and so on and so forth. And
Okay. So a puzzle is some kind of piece of data. I hadn't really quite thought about that. Is it like a big chunk of JSON that describes what's happening in the puzzle?
Sort of. So initially in those days, well, actually they had the original puzzles at the time were in some sort of Firebase database, but most of the puzzles created by the community weren't actually in this format. Because this particular tool, so the tool they were using also had an editor, but the person who made it asked them not to share it with anybody. So only they were using it. So every puzzle they used, they actually had to rebuild from scratch in this other editor. So it was already like that was the beginning of the weirdness of the whole thing. And there was, I think, yeah, there were basically two major other tools at the time called FPuzzles, and the other one called Penpa. And that's what most people were doing, building puzzles in. And I reverse engineered the format of their tool. And yes, it was, at the time, the puzzles were basically just really long URLs. The data was in the URL. So it was, you know, base64, LZ, compressed, JSON, basically. And a lot of these URLs were, you know, a couple of kilobytes long. And, you know, over time, that was causing all sorts of issues, as you can imagine.
Pretty long URL.
I wish I would have known that. I would have been so smart looking because I could just like decode the base64 and be like, oh, I guess that's 987532.
In fact, the URLs you see nowadays, I really just started doing that late last year where I said, okay, we're having a lot of problems with these long URLs. And I'll just, every time I see one of these long URLs, I just put it in a file and give it an ID and give you that URL back, right? Because people would put things into a URL shortener. That was like the primary way of sharing these puzzles. In fact, both of the editors, I think, had buttons to literally just give you a short URL directly.
A short URL? Yeah, okay.
And a couple of years ago, what was it called? Git.io? The GitHub URL shortener went down. It took thousands of puzzles out of circulations. Puzzles no record of that just disappeared from the face of the earth.
Ugh.
So there's a lot of things like that going on. I'm like, that's terrible. This shouldn't be happening, you know? But I mean, this is like, we just skipped 3 years of evolution there. The initial launch, and when I basically went full-time on the project, you know, I talked to Simon Mark from Cracking the Cryptic. Mm-hmm. And I had hoped at the time to take over because they had a mobile app out with a studio in Seattle from Studio Goya. And I had hoped like, hey, you know, this app has nothing to do with the thing you're using in your videos. That's all kind of weird, you know. And my plan was to sort of say, hey, maybe I can take over from Studio Goya and do, you know, mobile apps with you and earn money that way while we're running the website and have the free tool there. And that didn't quite work out that way. The initial thing was really just like, over 3 months, I'll do a very quick sort of proof of concept app. We'll just take exactly what's on the website. We'll throw it in a mobile app. Basically, the difference being that you can, you know, save your puzzles locally and play them on the plane and so on and so forth, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I released that early on, and that's literally still the only app I've made so far. So it's been carrying the whole thing. That's the only income, right, for the site, because the site itself is free.
The site's free. The apps are paid, like if you download it from iOS or something.
But the apps are basically, and the problem is now the apps are actually quite out of date, so they're struggling with the feature set. And I had some problems. the way, because the apps are completely the same technology stack, so it's all JavaScript, CSS, HTML, and the apps run the same way as the website, which means all the data is stored in local storage, which behaves very strangely in certain ways.
Can get flushed, unfortunately.
Not just can get flushed, updates wipe it on iOS, which I had known at the time. So the first time I did an update, big outcry, all my puzzles are gone. I had 300 puzzles, you know? And I'm like, oh darn, you know? And the problem is I couldn't update without doing it again. Mm-hmm. So I got very shy about updating it. And then the more sort of the longer it took for me to update, the more other things came in the way. And now the app version, especially on iOS, is like 2 years out of date. And the only reason it still sort of works is because all the links pass, and I had the foresight, thankfully, to do that, all the links basically pass through a little interstitial page, you know, to go into the whole deep linking thing. I don't know if you're familiar, but, you know, you can make an app, you can register an app to just, if you're going to a particular URL, it loads the app instead of the web browser, right?
Like sudokupad://
Yeah, something like that.
Some actually, ID
I think
or something.
sudokupad.svencodes.com. Because I didn't know, I didn't want to risk it hooking the full domain, right? But basically what happened over the years then is that code that sits there actually parses the puzzle and re-encodes it to make it backwards compatible. Because over the years, things got into the puzzle that exposed bugs in the app and would screw the app, basically. For example, there was some styling information that would override global styles. So you got a cage, for example, you mentioned the cages earlier. Mm-hmm. If you got a cage that was invisible with a transparent color, suddenly all your other puzzles also would have no longer visible cages, because it overwrote the global styling in the mobile app.
Oh, just one puzzle that you're not even playing.
Exactly.
Had some styles.
Exactly. Oh, as soon as it generates the thumbnail within the app, it would load the puzzle, overwrite the global styles, and mess the whole app
up,
right?
Yeah, so I ended up scope those styles, baby.
Yeah, so I'm basically decoding the puzzles, looking for cages without styles, and artificially make them all black lines, right? Like, that's just one of the many things it does. Okay. And that's just one of the many, many, many little sort of nooks and crannies of weird code that deals with backwards compatibility and this whole weird tech stack.
That's like a little in the weeds. Let's paint a little bit more of a picture here. So you open up SudokuPad and you see a grid. There's, you know, 9 columns and 9 rows, and that's like the traditional Sudoku thing. But the kind of the point of this app existing is that you need to draw more crap onto that grid to accommodate the puzzle. Little circles and dots and dashed lines and numbers and all kinds of stuff. So you have some work ahead of you to kind of render what that puzzle needs to be. Then it also needs presumably the answer to the puzzle in there somewhere, so you can know that if you did a good job or not. And then you need to build in all the interactivity of how people can deal with the puzzle. So you have lots of jobs. This app is, you know, despite it looking a little simple, is probably anything but. It's really quite the complex piece of logic, right?
Yeah, I mean, the sort of selling factor for it is usability, right? So what sets it apart from the other tools I mentioned earlier, which people use to create puzzles, and the reason why people don't like to solve puzzles in them is usability. And usability is not something that you think of when you're building something for fun or open source or as a hobby, or especially when it comes to, let's say, usability for touchscreens or different device layouts and things like that, right? So my focus was very high on usability, making the tools work. I stressed very hard over, you know, hotkeys and making buttons work and things like that.
That does seem like a very, very big deal. I have used some really shitty Sudoku apps in the past and have been underwhelmed by them, and it becomes less fun to do the job. I'd rather use a pencil instead anyway, because the app sucks so much. It does seem like that was a big deal with this app. And when you watch Simon and Mark do it and their proficiency in using your tool, you're like, dang, this is excellent. For example, they could be like, oh, the 3 is in one of these 3 squares, and they either drag their mouse across the 3 squares and just presumably hit, you can't see their hands in the video, but they just probably just hit the 3 key on their keyboard, and it puts the number in those 3 things. The fact that you could so easily select all 3 of those things, just that little detail is a pretty big deal. Imagine using the software and you have to click each one and then unclick it. Like just that little one feature, I'm sure there's 100 features like that, but just that one would be enough to not use or use an app. It would be such a big deal.
In fact, I think there's at least 5 different ways of changing which tool you're currently using. And the reason for that is partially because of all these other tools, because one tool would use spacebar to change, you know, and then I said, well, I don't want to cycle through all the tools. So I want to have shift spacebar to go the other way, you know. But then mm-hmm. I don't even remember if it's page up, page down or whatever. Then there was the convention of ZXCV, you know, the bottom row on the keyboard, selecting the tools directly. So it supports that.
You can just put your left hand down there?
I don't even know all the different ways. But of course, my tool didn't just have 4 tools. It has additional tools, which I implemented as a sort of kind of plugin infrastructure. You know, you have the color tool, but there were other tools which most people don't use.
I was going to ask you about that well, too. Let's do it. Let's get into the weeds a little bit. For example, there's one where you can draw a line because some puzzle rule sets have it. It's part of what you're trying to solve is the rule will say, you know, draw a line that starts in column 1, row 1 and ends in row 9 or something, but only moves orthogonally or something like that. Well, how do you draw that line? Well, in other software, you just say you can't, or I don't know, print it out and do it with a pencil. But your tool has what's called the pen tool in it. But I was always curious about this because it's never really been covered on a show. Why is it off by default? Is there, you know what I mean? Like you have a tool that can do it, but it's just not there.
I need to change that actually. That, again, this is sort of historical because the original tool didn't have it. And most puzzles don't require it. And one of the plans I had for a long time is I need to let the puzzle setters to indicate to the app which tools would be required. So for example, there is a killer cage calculator. And it doesn't make sense to show it on a... Okay, let me step back a little bit because I think we're leapfrogging because one of the problems is that the app... That these are not Sudoku puzzles. If they were Sudoku puzzles, it would be easy. Or they're not only Sudoku puzzles. So the app cannot rely on them being Sudoku puzzles. So it cannot rely on them being 9x9. It cannot rely on them using digits 1 through 9. So a lot of the... you know, there's probably half the code base is basically all workarounds trying to figure out what's going on, like even to know where the grid is itself, because there might be elements that are outside the board. Yeah. So
those puzzles where you have to find the grid are so mind-bending to me.
But not even that, like puzzles that have elements outside the board to indicate things, you know, the problem is the app, the original tools creating these puzzles had no way of specifying these things, right? Or not all of them had, right? So my app doesn't actually accept that information. It basically looks at the visual data. It's more or less a picture, and then it tries to figure out what the picture means, which is really tricky. So, for example, for the longest time, I was trying to figure out certain rules from parsing the text. So that there's a little piece of text describing the rules, and I said, if the text has the words "knights move away" in it, then I can know that that's probably a rule. But the problem is,
no freaking way. You look for the text "knights move away" in the rule.
Oh my God. And I'll tell you why I'm not doing that anymore. The problem,
because I don't know what a knight's move is.
One of the problems is obviously if the rule is something like "odd digits a nice move away," right? So it's easy to tell that to a human, but especially if those pieces are far apart, like short of a modern, you know, large language model to parse that, you know.
This is a knight's move puzzle, but it only affects odd characters. That's a different sentence.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
I basically would go through a list of about 4,000 test puzzles I had, and I would apply a regular expression to them until I got, you know, most things correctly. And for a while, that was fine. And then after a time, I was noticing some performance issues, and then I was digging into it, and it turns out that my little fragments of regular expressions that I was pushing together resulted in 46 kilobytes of regular expression being executed.
Oh, gosh, Sven.
And apparently that slowed the browser down quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, I might guess so. That's wild. Not to mention, they're known for being a little fragile. I mean, right?
Exactly. It was still not complete, right? It was just like every time I found a case, I added something to the regular expressions to handle it. You know what? I would have been better off manually going through the puzzles and just clicking a button and marking them, you know?
Wow.
But that's that's the evolution. Like, that's part of what I enjoy about it. Like, I'm not a puzzle guy. I'm not a product guy. I'm not a, you know, business guy. I'm a code guy, and I love programming. I love JavaScript. And
I was so curious about that. You're not even a puzzle guy? You don't even do these puzzles?
I test, right? But that's the thing, right? Like, I get to the point now where I test and I play a lot, and I'll just do simple puzzles quickly to make sure I haven't blown anything up after I release a new update.
Right. I
don't know if you guys looked at the version number, but it's currently at version 0.528.0.
Oh, okay.
So I'm only 528 versions into pre-release.
Almost there. You're almost out there.
I have commitment issues.
No breaking changes, so you're fine.
Yeah,
so,
let me give you an overview, because I think we haven't mentioned that yet. The renderer is actually pure SVG.
Okay.
There's a couple of ways of going about these things nowadays. You know, you can do HTML, you can do SVG, you can do Canvas. Those are the main ones, right? And the very first prototype was actually, I started with some HTML for, like, you know, just the grid and the digits and all this stuff.
Right.
And you could do a lot of the line drawing with HTML as well if you get funky with CSS. But then I wanted to have something that looks good on different screens and different devices, works well. And it was partially also like, do it quickly, right? Like prototyping stage. Oh, you know, if I can just generate an SVG and it'll be quick, and, you know.
I don't know. There's a lot of diagonal lines and stuff. I don't know. So SVG seems like the right way to go here, just anecdotally.
Yeah, and for example, one of the editing tools uses Canvas, and they have a problem where it basically just re-renders everything 60 frames per second, and your laptop will basically overheat, and your battery will drain when that app is open. And in the meantime, people have created like browser extensions to make it only re-render when something changes and stuff like that.
Wow. Yeah, they hacked the Canvas rendering
basically,
loop to slow it down.
Of course, it's very difficult, because in a Canvas render, it's very hard to access what's inside, right? You can't just look at this, you know, you can just open your DevTools and have a look under the bonnet, you know? And with the SVG one, it's a lot easier. You can just right-click on it and like, oh, okay, there's a box here, or there's a line here, or whatever, you know? So that was a decision I'm actually quite happy about. There have been issues. I have several Chromium bug reports since I started this. it's apparently pretty good at finding bugs in Chromium and Safari. Their filter implementations
are... Don't doubt it. So in the puzzle rule, I mean, maybe this is too specific. So if it is, just you feel free to go down the path you were already going. But I'm fascinated by it. Like, it doesn't even assume a 9x9 grid. Like, there's not like structured data that says, oh, actually, this puzzle's 12x12. That doesn't exist. There's no data that says that.
There's a grid that can be 12x12. But, for example, there's a puzzle. If you go to sudoku.app on the homepage, right, and that page is hardly unchanged from before I released it. This was really for people to test the app. So if you go to just sudoku.app without a puzzle, that's a very, very old page. And those puzzles were basically for the testers at the time. And if you go down to, I think it's the fourth one, two, three, four, called Partial Coded Killer. And that's one of those puzzles where it has like a substitution cipher, so it has letters in the grid, and then it has a little 5x2 area or 6x2 area with the letters and little boxes next to them where you can put in digits. So you can say, the one, A is a 1 or a 2,
right? Yeah, this is such a niche thing. I've never seen this, but your thing supports it. How?
Yeah. So this is technically, you know, any human looks at this and says, okay, there's a 9x9 puzzle and has something on the outside, right? But the data says this is a 9x11 puzzle, right? And my tool has no way of knowing that these boxes on the side are special, right? Like, you know, that duplicate side are suddenly allowed, because obviously the A can be a 1, and then there's a 1 in row 1, and then there's two 1s in that row, and what's going on, right? And I had to get pretty clever over time to kind of try to look at the data and try to guess what it means, And the moment you do that, then somebody does something different with the data, right?
And it's not a data format that you invented either, right?
Exactly.
It's this bastardized.
And nobody has invented it really. Like, it's not written down anywhere, right? It's.
You should write it down. You should.
But the thing is, I don't want to specify it, because a lot of the creativity that's come out of the community has been because the data format has been so lax. For example, one thing my code did, which is a big no-no if you're a professional programmer, it basically forwarded a lot of properties and didn't really analyze or filter them properly. So a lot of the JSON just gets stuffed into the SVG elements on the other end. And that meant somebody independently created an import tool from the Penpa format, which is very, very different from the FPuzzles format. And my tool can import FPuzzles, so they create FPuzzles data from the Penpa tool, but the Penpa format has much more capability than FPuzzles. Like FPuzzles, for example, like lines always go to a center or to the edge of a cell, not arbitrary positions, things like that, right? But he could do that because my system was so forgiving that it just accepted the data and pushed it through, and then he just, well, I can just now render arbitrary data, and I've seen people draw background images just with lines by basically injecting SVG data more or less without going through SVG, you know? And it's kind of all, like, there's stuff out there that I don't understand how it works. You know, I can kind of decipher it, but it'll take me half an hour. And I'm kind of super happy that it worked out that way because it makes it more interesting and it makes it, like, the community owns it in that sort of weird way. It's like a modding thing almost.
It scares me a little bit as a programmer, but I like that you're like, I'm going to intentionally be flexible because I'm honoring the creativity of these setters. That's kind of cool. I mean, every bone in my body says, like, too bad, we're going to have a data format. It's going to look like this, and you're going to use it.
Most of my work is backwards compatibility nowadays. Like, I'm currently working very hard on creating a database for these are not in a database, right? They are currently literally files on the server, and the ID is just the file name. And because I used to deploy to Firebase, it used to be in the Git repo, and eventually Git status took over 5 minutes. And I'm like, wait a second, this isn't right. I can't do this. This doesn't work for me.
Are they enormous? What's the size of a puzzle?
No, but there's over 100,000 of them now.
Oh, my God. That'll do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Git doesn't like that, apparently. In fact, I spent a whole weekend purging all the history from Git because otherwise the repo was just unusable. It didn't matter if the files were in there.
Is it private, or can I really want to see
one. It's currently private, yes.
Okay.
It's weird because it's a commercial product, so I don't officially open source it, but the code isn't really minified either. So the code that's on the site is the code I have locally. People can literally save it and have the local version running if they want to. I would say, hey, it's still my code, and you're technically violating the copyright. It's more like I don't want somebody else to just take it and make an app out of it, and you know, somebody with a bigger budget, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
My dream would be to open source it if my Patreon would support me and I wouldn't have to sell it as an app, right? I feel like that would be the best thing for the community as a whole. But we've been managing so far. Like I said, the code is not exactly closed source. You know, the repo right now is probably not worth looking at either.
So there's 100,000. I mean, nobody has done... These aren't written by hand, but they're also not made by a tool? I don't understand.
When I say 100,000, there's 100,000 of these short IDs. I call them short IDs, right? It's basically these shorted URLs. They resolved around 47,000 unique puzzles, right? So there's a lot of duplication. So there's a lot of noise going on where people press buttons twice and I don't do any validation on my end and so on. And that's the work I'm currently doing, is to clean that all up. You know, one of the questions I've been asking myself is, what is a puzzle? Because I want to have a group of these bits of data joined together into one puzzle. You know, a puzzle that's under construction where people add things, where they maybe change the title, or where they add the solution at the very end, or where they make a small fix before they release it. You know, those all things should be under one umbrella that represents one puzzle, the history of that one puzzle, right? And I'm actually talking with some mathematicians from a university in the States to try to figure out an algorithm that kind of determines the difference between one puzzle and the next in sort of a vector space, you know what I mean? Like saying, oh, you know, these two puzzles are this similar and these two puzzles are really different, you know? So there's a lot of this sort of data science stuff going on that I'm very interested in. And as you can imagine, a lot of the people are math geeks. A lot of the people are programmers as well that are into puzzles. There's a lot of mathematicians in the audience, right? So it's kind of a weird place because it's like I'd love to be in the video game industry, but I can't really claim that title because I'm not making the puzzles, right? It's more of a, that's why I call it SudokuPad. It's like Notepad. It's a word processor, and people are loading their own puzzles into it, right? And use it to play them, right?
I think that's the coolest part about it is it's not just a Sudoku app. It's like a tool, a app that helps you make a Sudoku to give to somebody to play, right?
Or, and kind of, but we didn't quite cover that, right? Let's say you're Fistimafel. Do you make the puzzle, or do Fistimafel email Sven and you make the puzzle?
No. So Fistimafel will go to a tool like FPuzzles or Penpa. Those are the main two. There's also a tool called Sudoku Maker. That was built very recently. And Sudoku Maker is unique because it was built in the SudokuPad era, and it doesn't actually have a way of playing the puzzles. It just has a open in SudokuPad button at the top, which I very much appreciate.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah, there's also Sudoku Studio, which was sort of the big open source project that was started a long time ago.
So it's kind of a opportunity for you, though, to make a tool that is...
I should, but right now... Okay, so right now what I'm really working on is to turn SudokuPad, the website, into an actual place to find puzzles, because there's no discovery, right? You have to have the link to a puzzle that I don't necessarily know exists, right? And that is a big problem in the community. So, for example, my traffic on the site, I have about 40,000 unique users every day. But month over month, about 60% of the users are new, which means 60% of the users leave, right? Exactly. And my traffic, while it's going up just a tiny bit every month, it's... like it's been literally a straight line with a slight angle since 3 years. And that's because of that churn, right? And the reason is because they go, they play their puzzle, and then a lot of people don't know of any other puzzles. You know, there's a lot of YouTubers that use my app. There's dozens of them now. There is, you know, the Discord is a big place, but a Discord is not where people go, like, unless they already know about it. And what I'm working on is I want SudokuPad to become sort of the YouTube of puzzles. I want the puzzle setters to go there and publish the puzzles as a channel. And I want CDC to have a channel of the puzzles they play on their videos. And
oh,
I want,
that'd be great. A homepage for the app that showed the like the 10 coolest, you know, the trending puzzles that day. I mean, you know I work on CodePen. Oh, I forgot to mention that. You mentioned that the first demo of it was on CodePen. I didn't know that when I emailed you. I had no idea. I just thought it was an interesting story. And I'm like, I'm sorry, you used my app to build your app? At least the first version? I'm like, that's so cool.
I love using CodePen for like prototyping and quick things like that. I've used it in a while now, but in those days I had my whole little framework where I would have multiple pens that were libraries that I loaded in. I worked on my 3D card game back in the day, and a lot of it in CodePen, a lot of the prototypes there. Don't look at my account there. It's a total mess of just like abandoned prototypes. It's not really beautifully curated.
Nah, so is everybody's, you know, that's just the way it is. But I'll just say one of the smart things we did was putting trending cool stuff on the homepage of the app. You know, we've made it kind of a community thing. So, you know, I would offer that as a suggestion. Going to the home, having the app have some kind of homepage that shows you the trending puzzles would be kick ass.
Well, the big thing right now is to get to have user accounts. So step one, user accounts. So I want, right now, what is the legal situation of puzzles, right? If I want to show 1,000 puzzles, they're not my puzzles. I didn't make them. I don't have any rights to them, right? Many of these puzzles are commercial projects that aren't available for free. There's people who sell these behind paywalls. There's people who sell them on Etsy as PDF files. I got an email from a guy who asked me, he's kickstarting a puzzle book, and he's asking if that's okay to link to my site for the puzzles, right? The Cracking the Cryptic books, all the links go to my site for playing the puzzles. Mm-hmm. They don't want people to play those puzzles without buying the book, right? So I have no good way right now.
God, that is complicated.
Oh. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So part of it is also to sanitize the data set, right? So I want accounts for all the setters, and I want, you know, once they publish puzzles there, I want them to check boxes and say, okay, this is how my puzzle is allowed to be used, you know? You know, for example, right. I want this puzzle to show up as a play next at the end of another puzzle, or I want this puzzle to show up.
Like how YouTube does. That's what you mean by YouTube of Sudoku.
Exactly.
Yeah, you got a lot of work ahead of you, man. Oh, I'm just saying.
One man shop here. I got a contact earlier this year about advertising on the site, and that was a total mess. I tried a little bit of Google AdSense until one of the professors said, oh, my partner who's a teacher wants to do puzzles with her kids. And then they got an ad for, I don't know, bikini girls on the beach, right? Ugh, and I'm like, I pulled them immediately because I was making like $5 a day, right? It was just a test, right?
Does any money change hands between you and CTC, or is that just a handshake deal? Or?
Well, the money is changing hands. It's not the direction you would expect, because I'm paying them 50% of my income on the apps for the promotion. So that's a bit of a problem for me because, you know, I'm not really making a lot of money, I'll be honest. And that's part of why I want to do this bigger project. I need to keep some of that 60% that's leaving every month, right? Because I want to do more apps, and I the only promotion I have is now on this site, right? So I can only promote to my own community. And that's part of why I'm like this advertising system. I'm building it from scratch now. I want people to, who currently, you know, there isn't a lot of commercial activity. There's a few people who have Patreons. There's some people who, like I said, sell PDFs on Etsy. There's other people who have, you know, PayPal links on their website, and then you get an email and things like that, you know. But they're all using my site for free. And okay, I don't make the puzzles, but I'm still working every day for the last 3 years on this thing. And I need to make it sustainable somehow. And that's, you know, part of why I'm working with Rami Ismail at the moment to help me out, kind of figure the business side of that. And
Rami's great. Rami's from Vlambeer.
Yeah, yeah.
Very talented.
You know, I've known him for many years. And I was in near Amsterdam visiting a friend. And I was like, wait a second, Rami lives around here somewhere. And I sent him a tweet, and he's like, yeah, let's meet up. And then we had a coffee, and he thought the whole thing was so interesting and original. He was actually interested kind of long-term to be part of it somehow. Because like this whole thing was such a weird amalgamation of technology, of community, of opportunity, of something unusual, you know? Like I said, it's like the early internet,
yeah,
you know?
It is all those things, I'll tell you that, yeah.
And as crazy as it feels to still be doing everything from scratch myself, which, you know, all my professional instinct says, don't do that. Why are you doing that? You know, I've like I mentioned earlier, it's the mobile apps that are all built on the same JavaScript code base, run through Cordova, iOS, Android, Steam. I wanted to be, you know, I've worked in a studio before where we had teams taking care of that stuff. And I wanted to do it beginning to end myself. So the next time I'm running a team, I can say, hey, this is how it works. This is why you're doing it. This is what's going on, you know? And Cordova is a horrible technology. It's so old. It's so unsupported. And in fact, I'm working on a new version now using, oh my God, what's the new one now?
What is the new one? Ionic or?
Well, Ionic is kind of the wrapper capacitor I'm working on with, right?
Okay, Ionic capacitor. Okay, yeah, yeah.
It's a very confusing landscape because Cordova is... A lot of things just don't work, and a lot of the documentation is out of date and stuff. And the premise is simple. Like, every operating system has a web view, you know. You can build a fully functional app with all the trimmings in JavaScript on a website. You know, almost all the technologies are available nowadays. You know, you want to read, write to files, you can do that through web APIs. You know, you want to access a camera, you want to load from a remote server. For example, we did a 24-hour live stream funding live stream for StokuCon 2025 late last year, and I created basically a real-time multiplayer sort of system where it transmitted all the moves, including mouse movements, through the server, so we could so we basically could have people connected with their webcam, but we had a local recording of the board on the streaming server. So you could log into a board and you could see the mouse movements off the host, right? So you had like a host client multiplayer dashboard sort of thing going on. I put it together in like 3 days before the stream, you know.
Well, that's good. Yeah, it seems like a problem for someone else to solve somehow. We use you should look at ably.com. I think they have kind of a plug and play kind of thing. That's the thing, right?
Nowadays, it would take you 3 days just to try three different services, read their documentations, do the samples, and then decide amongst them. You know what I mean? Like,
right, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Nothing isn't as quick and easy as they make it out to be. It is quick and easy once you have made the decision, once you've read the docs and you've done the sample, right?
Right.
But for me, it's always like, and that's why I often end up doing things myself, because I've tried it both ways, and often I get this sort of decision paralysis, right? It's like, oh, you know, like with capacitor, it was... Man, the number of times I had like 3, 4, 5, 6 different technologies, pros and cons, and tried the samples, and then you hit a roadblock because the documentation is out of date and the sample just doesn't run. And the thing, oh yeah, you're doing the wrong thing. You need to do this. And then you try to do this thing, and then the other thing is the wrong version. And JavaScript is a bit of a mess, let's be honest, especially server-side JavaScript. You know, like in the browser, it's almost simple nowadays because it's so well supported.
Well, and these, like, I guess what benefits are you like getting exactly out of like the native bridge other than just deploying to an app store?
Do you? And that's it, right? Charging money for it.
That's the one thing you need, huh?
So,
my gosh.
Really?
So basically having an account system is exactly where I can then say, okay, hey, for $5 a month, you get this extra feature, you know?
The main
feature being cloud saves, right? People play on their phone and then they want to continue on their computer and they want to have it local. And
That's pretty big.
Yeah, I did a prototype PWA. Like, there's no reason to have a mobile app. I should be able to run the website offline well enough. You know, you should be able to press a button, get your last 300 puzzles into local storage when you go on a flight and then play the puzzles, you know, in theory, right? In practice, your browser hiccups and then your site is gone and it's not in cache anymore, right? But you guys probably know more about that stuff than me because I've, you know, I've done the prototypes and the experiments, but not the actual thing yet.
Well, it's notoriously hard, but yeah.
It does seem like you need two kinds of accounts too. Like you want to get those setters having accounts because that solves kind of the confusing, like what's allowed and what's not allowed on this app thing. But you also want just regular user accounts too for the saving stuff.
Sure. It'll be like YouTube, right? Like every YouTube account can publish videos, but you know, 99% of them don't. They're just viewers. That's kind of how I envision it.
It's one kind of account with different types. Yeah.
Well, I don't see a reason. I'll just have an account if you want to publish a puzzle, you know, because I think there's a bit of a pipeline as well of people enjoying the puzzles, playing more, and then trying their hand and making one. It's kind of almost a graduation thing if it's easy to do. But like you guys have realized, you don't know how, right? You don't know where to go with that, even if you had an idea for a puzzle, right? And I would love to promote that.
Yeah, I do think about it occasionally. I'm like, I wonder if I could I even pull it off, you know? I don't know.
There are lots of streamers and YouTubers that make videos about how to make puzzles, right? In fact, I want to cooperate with them and make some puzzles. Like, I have never set a puzzle. So this is long in the works. I want to do a video series of teaching Sven how to make a puzzle, you know? And then use that.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
But that's the thing, right? You wouldn't even know where to look. You don't know about... A lot of these YouTuber accounts are very small and very niche, you know? And with my site, I have the platform to say, hey, if you want to learn how to make a puzzle, here are three YouTube accounts that tell you how to, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you're in a unique position because you're a one-man shop. You have all kinds of opportunity right and left, but you got to pick the right thing. You know, if you spend too long making a YouTube series about puzzle setting or something, it's at the cost of your time doing something else. And at the moment, you kind of got the lock on you're the app that people link to play the puzzles in. It's the best one, right? So you kind of got to hold on to that. You don't want to get ousted of that.
The thing is, it's also a strange place where the communities and the niches are still kind of small. You know, like there's a lot of people who go to sudoku.com, right? A lot of those people have never heard of CTC. You know, CTC has 500,000 YouTube viewers, but how many millions of visitors does sudoku.com have, right? How many millions of visitors has the New York Times Sudoku page? Right. And I've always said, hey, if they come to me and they want to white label my app to use it on their site, I think they should do that. Right. But they probably don't even know who I am.
They don't like you go to the New York Times one or whatever. They don't have any variants, do they?
Oh, yeah. No. Like and I understand why, because of the mass appeal and the difficulty of teaching variant rules, because variant by definition means it could be anything. Right. And that's part of the beauty of it.
Oh, they could tiptoe. They could tiptoe with just a few cages or something.
Sure. Yeah. And I hope to do that. I hope to have that pipeline of teaching people like, hey, you want to try one or two of the common constraints. Here are the most popular constraints. Here are the best puzzles of the week. Here are the most popular ones. Here, oh, you like this Fistomafel puzzle on cracking the cryptic. Here's an easy puzzle that uses 50% of those constraints, you know, that kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the real value there, because I think one of the things that CTC hasn't done well is the growth of the community. Their growth has been sort of incidental, but they haven't really been pushing. You know, like it's very hard to go from watching a YouTube video, like an hour long solved by Simon, to being able to solve such a puzzle or even enjoying that process.
Yeah, no, I don't even want to. I just like to... my whole goal in the puzzle is to notice one thing before Simon notices it, and then I go to bed.
Are you active in the Discord?
No, I did join it at one point, and I was like, this is a mess, dude. It's like...
But that's the thing. The Discord is the premier place for this stuff. but it's so inaccessible, right? It's so inaccessible. For example, in Discord, there is a channel where we have a daily Sudoku puzzle, right? It's called a gas puzzle, you know, the generally approachable Sudoku. And Mark solves them, or used to solve them, like once a week he did five of them or something. And those are the kind of puzzles you can solve between 5 to 10 minutes.
Okay.
And a lot of them are about one particular constraint. And they're very much almost teaching you that constraint, right? They're almost like, hey, anybody can solve this killer puzzle,
Here's
right?
Here's a German Whispers line and or whatever.
But what I really need is a tutorial, a course on the site. You know, at the end when you've gone through the
it
puzzle.
It seems like new enough. Like, when was the first variant Sudoku puzzle? You know, I mean, maybe it was a long time ago, but it seems like relatively recent popularity.
Yeah, popularity-wise, it's. I mean, like, I'm not a Sudoku scholar. I've recently seen a graph about this steep spike in Sudoku popularity on Google Trends in like 2016, I think, or 2006, a while back, and then it went down. But now it's kind of slowly hopping up again. Like, it on that graph, it doesn't look like a lot, but it's almost 50% up from like a couple of years ago. So I think there's something happening. And things like variant Sudokus, I mean, the puzzle category, I think, is called pencil puzzles. And pencil puzzles are basically puzzles you can play on a grid with a pencil. So they include line puzzles, they include shading puzzles and things like that, not necessarily with the numbers. And my tool kind of aims to support a variety of pencil puzzles, not explicitly, but in theory, you can do a lot.
Yeah.
But the number stuff is super popular because it's international. It's not language-based, right?
Like
word puzzles are, you know, Cracking the Cryptic used to be about crosswords. But they don't translate very well, right? Number puzzles
especially
do.
Especially cryptic ones. Those are just out of so British. Whack. I don't even enjoy watching them. They're just like, what are you talking about? Have you crossed the barrier of being able to, even though they can be called pencil puzzles as a category, it seems like you Sudoku Pad allows you to do stuff that, like, you'd just be erasing too much. There's just too much crap in the grid to actually do it with an actual pencil. Like, there's just, it's too information dense for that at this point.
Yeah, it's just a terminology, right? It's I mean, I don't even fully understand what the definition is. I just know that there's some people who say, oh, I would never play Sudoku Pad. I only use Penpa. And Penpa stands for pencil puzzles, right? And they'll have hex grids and triangular grids. And like, okay, you know, they have a 3D cube grid. And like, I could add those things. But I look at the numbers, right? And I look at what percentage of people play what. And I look at the average length of people playing puzzles. And while a two-hour Fistomophil solve on Cracking the Cryptic is really exciting as a spectator sport, like StarCraft 2, it is not the thing that people play, right? And that's the other thing. The other side of it is, like, a lot of people tell me, oh, we don't have a, like, you need users to specify the, like, rate puzzles and things like that. And I'm like, you know what? I've done analysis of play times of puzzles, and I get beautiful bell curves. And those bell curves very much correlate to a perceived difficulty, even though you don't agree with it, because you don't understand that once 1,000 or 10,000 people do a thing, the statistics do become significant, even if one person is faster than another, you know? And that's what I'm hoping to bring to the table is, you know, one other major site about puzzles is Logic Masters Germany, which is where a lot of these puzzles start out as, where they are being published. It is a site where people publish puzzles. But there, the puzzles get 5 to 25 solves. 25 solves, there's a success. The same puzzle will have 5,000 solves on Sudoku Pad, right? And with those numbers, I can now go in and say, okay, what are popular puzzles? What are...
God, you have great metadata then. Yeah, you absolutely could find popular stuff.
I did an analysis of one of the YouTubers. He asked for some information about the length of puzzles he's played, and he sent me saves of his replay data. So that's 1,300 replays he's done. And, you know, I figured out he spent 630 hours playing puzzles in Sudoku Pad. I've done some work with the professors at the university who are working on, like, there's literally, my name is on a couple of grants now where they're doing research on this stuff, right? Where they want to play, like, they're doing studies into education, like, how does playing the puzzles correlate with educational performance and kids and things like that, you know, like, what do they call it? Extracurricular education, you know, hey, numbers could be fun, right? And I'm very interested in saying, hey, you know, if I have enough people playing puzzles, and I look at how they play and where they pause and when they put in digits. I've done heat maps of, like, you can tell like what people look at when, at what time during, you know, anyway, like a lot of stuff like that, that I don't really understand, but I do understand data. And I know that if you statistically analyze enough data, you can, maybe you don't get the perfect answer, right? But I'm pretty sure I can get to a point where I can show a puzzle to somebody that's fairly well aligned with their ability, with what they enjoy, what they, you know.
Oh, I didn't even think about that. I'm like, where are you going with this? You're like, oh, I'm gonna give you a puzzle based, yeah, a recommendation based on your skill level that I have analyzed. That's pretty cool. Although down the road a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that could be pretty simple too. It's just like Dave solved this puzzle in 30 minutes and similar users who have solved that puzzle in 30 minutes also solve this puzzle in about 28. So you could even guide me on like a
right
little victory journey too.
And of maybe, course, you know, it could be off when you've played one puzzle, but then you've played two, then you've played three, and it'll get better, right? And it'll learn more about you. And that's why I also want to have this sort of YouTube channel system, because I want people to subscribe to each other. I want people to set up playlists. I want to learn up, you know, kind of do the Spotify thing. Like, hey, people who like these kind of puzzles also like these kind of puzzles, and you might also enjoy this, you know?
Oh, playlists would be awesome.
I would, as a tiny word of warning, not that this is a, this could be a most genius thing ever. I don't know what I know, but at one time, and this is still true on CodePen today, we set up machine learning based individual feeds for every single user. So even though you don't use it very often, you've ever used it, we have some data on it, and we feed these machine learning models data based on stuff that you do on the site. Like if you click and view a pen, that's like a little piece of data. If you comment on it, that's some data. If you heart it, that's a little piece of data. There's all kinds of things. There's a lot. There's a dozen or so different ways that you can interact with something on CodePen. And it's just forming like a little bit of a model about who you are. And then this machine learning model spits out pens that it thinks that you'll probably like based on your activity. So everybody's feed on CodePen is a little bit different. There's an algorithm of sorts. The problem is, it's just not that interesting, really. Like, chances are, like, the stuff on CodePen, you're just going to like it because it's cool. Like, every pen isn't so different from one another that you just won't like some sect of pens. I don't have like a ton of data on it, but I just am not that into it. And I just wonder if Sudoku is the same kind of vibe, that it's just like, they're all Sudoku puzzles, you know, like you're probably going to like them or whatever.
I mean, initially the plan is to do it all user driven, right? So it's like, hey, you like this YouTube channel, subscribe to them. That YouTube channel might be showcasing, you know, for example, Bremster showcases puzzles that are 20 to 30 minutes long versus Simon's 40 to 90 minutes, right?
The solve ranks, length is a big deal.
Yeah, Ranks does the New York Times hard puzzle every day, and he has an adventure series, much easier than, you know. So So somebody who subscribes to Bremster's channel and does more of those puzzles versus somebody who subscribes to Cracking the Cryptic's puzzle channel, I'm talking about what will be, right? But doesn't maybe solve the puzzles. They should tell me a lot already, but it's up to them, right? Initially, I don't need to do anything automatic or algorithmic. There's a bit of a bad taste about it, and I have no illusion. I'm a one-man shop. You know, I'm not going to build Google and YouTube and Spotify, you know, over the weekend, right? It's not going to happen. But the difference also is, in theory, I will have access to the entire replays. And because the way the app works internally, and I built this in from the very start, everything you do, every button you press, everything you click translates into an internal language of puzzle actions. And then it goes into a stack, and that's your undo and redo stack. And that's also your replay data. So when you're going into a puzzle that you've played earlier, it basically replays what you've done. And in fact, there's a replay tool in the settings. You should check it out, and it'll animate that for you. You can make a GIF from it. You can literally output a GIF of your solve, right? And with that data, because it includes timing information, I can say a lot more about, did you abort the solve? Did you finish the solve? Did you get stuck? Did you stop and then come back to it a day later? You know, like, I think the signal there will be much stronger to exclude puzzles you didn't enjoy, that you've just attempted, you know, or puzzles that you've solved and you were happy and, you know, and the usual rating afterwards, hey, I enjoyed this puzzle. Like, I'm doing a lot of that for myself. I want to be able to bookmark puzzles that I enjoyed. I want to make playlists and things like that, right?
Yeah. Collections was a good move for us, so try that, yeah. Yeah, pretty cool. You know, way back earlier mentioned, it's, you know, what sets this apart in some way is the usability or the I don't know, forget the exact term you use, but you mean like it's nice to use.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty clutch. And it has a lot of those features in it. It looks quite easy to use. Surely that's why the people who use it prefer it and like it. Not that it's the only one on the block, but it's that it's nice. You know, there's easy commands to use and it supports the features and stuff. I remember for the first time learning that, like when I used to do them on a piece of paper, not that I'm any good at it, but I'd like have my own little system where I'd put little dots and then the dots represent what number it could be or something like that. And it blew my mind when I first saw that there's a difference between two different types of numbers, corner marks and center marks. And generally, when you use a center mark, you're saying this cell can only be one of these center marks. So if you see center marks, that cell can only be those numbers. Whereas the corner marks are different. They say like, if you see multiple corner marks in a thing, it means that a three or whatever number it's going to be has to be in one of these positions. And that those are just totally different concepts. So one number system can't do it. You need two places to put numbers. And I don't know who originally developed this like corner versus center mark system, but it's genius. And now, I don't know, I feel like you got to have that. And there's a bunch of apps on the App Store that don't have the two kinds. They just have one kind of mark. And it's like, this is trash. I can't use it.
We call it Snyder notation because it was invented by a fellow Snyder, who is fairly famous in the community about, you know, early days of Sudoku. But for example, one of the early features I did was the color markings. And the Studio Goya apps that crack into cryptic cells, they had like one or two or three colors that you could choose.
Mm.
And I didn't like it. And I was like, and I was kind of breaking my, like at the time I was thinking very hard about like, how can I make that work similar to the number systems, you know, the pencil marks. And eventually I came up with this little color wheel where it's, you know, when you have two colors on a cell, it doesn't just make them half and half or mixes them or whatever. It cuts them diagonally. And then it splits it radially in this little star pattern.
And one can have like five colors or I don't even know if there's a limit, right?
But the funny thing is that is now has been adopted by Studio Goya and I've seen it pop up in other apps. So it's actually influencing other apps to do it the same way. And new apps that have been made use that because people are just so used to it now. And it's a little, I feel almost worried a bit because I don't feel like I've put enough thought into certain things to justify it being in 10 different sites and apps. I put enough thought of it being in my app, right? But if it becomes sort of a quote-unquote industry standard suddenly, you know, and it's not documented, it's not written down, you know, I have all these plans to write this stuff down, and that's never high on the priority list, unfortunately. You know, so it's a weird place to be where it's both trend-setting, but also the site is relatively small. You know, it's become big enough now. It's just gotten over a threshold where I'm getting acquisition offers, which was a very weird experience starting this year.
There you go. Dave's policy is that you should take
always the money. Always say yes. Take the money and run. Just buy a yacht, buy a nice boat.
Yeah, yacht. It's not yacht money, the offers. But the interesting part is that a lot of them missed the bigger picture. So the first offer I got, they didn't know I was making money off apps. They didn't know my traffic was coming from YouTube videos.
Mm.
They just saw my site pop up on some traffic comparison site with other puzzle website.
Right? Oh, I see.
Yeah. You got to be a little deciduous.
You see what I mean?
Yeah,
so it would be a bit useless to them because, you know, they wouldn't be able to drive the same traffic if they cut the community off that I bring to the table. Now, other offers I've gotten was just for the mobile app. So they find the mobile app on some sort of comparison site and they want to buy the mobile app. And I'm like, you know, but the source code, I can't give you ownership of that because my website runs off that, you know? And the app will not sell if I take the link down on my website because it doesn't rank for, I don't rank for Sudoku on the App Store. You know, it's like the app is being sold through the Cracking the Cryptic videos. So it's all kind of integrated and it's not a standard business model, you know. And that's the weird thing, right? It's like it's not just a game. It's not just an app. It's not just a website. It's all of those things. And the thing that it's missing right now is the community part because the community lives outside of the site. It lives on the Discord. It lives in the YouTube channels. And I want to bring that community on board. I want to be able to say, hey, instead of you finding a puzzle link on some YouTube video, I want you to come to my site, find the puzzle link, and then click to the YouTube video to watch the solve if you're interested. You know, that way around. And it'll be an interesting journey because there will be egos and toes being stubbed left, right, and center because some people, you know, won't like that, right? Some people feel very strongly about their puzzles where they should be. there's been people complain to me because I don't support some weird code feature that the Logic Masters Germany website uses for recording solves. And I'm like, Logic Masters Germany is like 300 people, you know? They're, you know, 5 minutes of my traffic.
Is
like, I'm
really?
Not going to build something for that, you know?
Oh, that's funny. I didn't know it was so few people because that gets...
I don't know. It's not 300 people per se, but the traffic, I think, is... My traffic is about six times their traffic or something like that.
Right. But it's the only way you get like a rating of a puzzle, right?
But that's the thing. Like, who gets that rating? The people who set the puzzles care about that stuff, right? But 90%, 95% of my audience, they don't know about that and they don't care. Yeah. So I'm not going to put a special feature in for, you know, I'd rather build that myself down the line.
Right.
But
like, you just finished it. Why don't you rate the puzzle or whatever?
Yeah. It's difficult, you know, and I have tried very hard to remain neutral. I almost don't want to build my own puzzle setting tool because I don't want to upset the part of the community that builds those tools. Because then I feel like I'm competing with them. Because the moment I build a puzzle setter tool, they'll build a player into their setting tool, right? And the people already used to setting that tool, those puzzles might never make it to me anymore, right? So it's a very, I feel like I have to be very careful where I tread and what I do and what I attempt.
Can the water shuffle under your feet a little bit too? I was curious about, we got to end this up in a minute, but I was curious about like, it was a, I don't know what it was. It doesn't feel like it's been that many years ago. And all of a sudden, fog of war puzzles started coming up where you can't see the whole grid. You can only see the thing. You didn't invent that, right? So all of a sudden, you wake up someday and be like, oh, man, my software has to support some new crazy rule thing.
Fog of war was fun. It was interesting. So there's this fellow chameleon, right? And he's kind of like me. He'll see something and he'll want it and he won't ask me to make it. He'll make it himself, right? So he has a site, Puzzle TV, I think it's called. And basically, every puzzle on that is kind of custom coded. So he'll come up with an idea, and he'll write the JavaScript to modify his engine, hard code it for that one puzzle. And that engine will run only that one puzzle. And that's how he made Fog of War. And I didn't even know it existed until it came onto Cracking the Cryptic. And I asked him, hey, you mind if I put it in? He's like, no, that's kind of what it's for, you know? And I put it in as a sort of gamble, because it's quite a bit of work to put in a new feature, and puzzles for it won't exist until I enable them to exist, right? Because other people couldn't make those puzzles. So I added the feature, and I kind of came up with a roundabout way of how to do it, and eventually, basically, because it, like, you know, F-Puzzles didn't, like, none of the puzzle makers supported Fog of War, right? So I said, okay, if you create a cage with an invisible total, and the total says the word fog or whatever, right? Then I'll you know, et cetera, et cetera. So it was, in F-Puzzles, it was kind of like that. And then somebody created browser extensions so people now can just click a button and do it. But it was kind of a three-step process, you know, to hack it into that puzzle format and so on and so forth. And it blew up and people love it. And I personally enjoy it very much. And again, I kind of went the extra mile, make the edges nice and work with filters. And I revised that SVG rendering so many times, little animations and things like that you probably don't even notice. And I kind of created a sort of unofficial policy and say, okay, any new feature request, I need you to design five puzzles at least. So I know that, you know, I'm not going to spend 3 days of work to put a feature in the app that only works for one puzzle and nobody can make another puzzle like it, you know? And people haven't really been taking me up on it because, again, I don't have a platform. I don't have a place where I can publish these things, and that's what the site is supposed to be. But I'd love to have these kind of puzzle setter-driven inventions and new technologies. And people are so bloody creative. They already figured out so many different ways of doing new puzzles on the site. And I have a long list of pending, double digits. Somebody's built a patch for it that works a year and a half ago, and I just need to put it in, you know. Letter mode, it was a similar thing. Letter mode, huge number of problems because suddenly all the hotkeys are kind of overridden and things like that. You know, you want to type in an A, or do you want to press Control A, or do you want to corner mark the letter A, or do you want to select all? I don't know, you know. So it's a never-ending thing, and that's part of what makes it fun as well.
We talked to this guy who made this, makes this really niche app for musicians that want to have the app play chords for them automatically. And one of the features of the app is that you can put your own songs into it. So he needed to design not only the app for people that just look up the song and play it, but for the people that like create the songs too. It's this two-sided thing, kind of like you have. And the way that you put in the apps, you can't just type in like play the G chord, C chord, D7, whatever. Yeah, because you need the key press to say which chord it's going to be when one block of is selected. So you can't, it's like you can't make these assumptions about what a key is going to do. And especially on the web, it sucks. Yeah.
Some hotkeys just are still, sometimes you press Control-3 and it just changes tabs. Like, and I don't think I can override those. And it's a bit of a pity.
Some you can, some you can't, you know?
Yeah, and it's not reliable. It's not the same from browser to browser. So I get a lot of issue reports from iOS. I'm not an iOS guy, so it's always very hard for me to test it and so on.
Yeah.
It's the world we live in, it's we've chosen to do things on the web. But it's tough. And people don't understand, right? They're just like, why does it not do the thing when I press the button? You know, it's like, well, I'd like to do the thing, but the browser won't tell me when you press the button, right? It won't. You know, there's nothing I can do about it. And I wish the browsers would get to the point now where they, because, you know, they wanted to make games in browsers a thing, right? And they need to give us a mode where you can just have it native quality, right? You need to be able to capture everything just like you can in a Windows app. The will isn't there, apparently.
Well, tricky, tricky.
Hopefully it gets better soon. We do have to wrap this up, but thank you so much, Sven, for coming on the show. For people who are following you and giving you money, how can they do that?
If they go to svencodes.com, there's links to Patreon and Ko-fi, which all the best people in the world go to give me money and let me do this thing.
Fun. Perfect.
Awesome. I'm completely unbiased.
It's just the best people in the world. Well, that's very cool. And I just feel like I've met like a celebrity just from like, you know, my sphere of YouTubes and stuff. So thank you very much for coming on the show. And thank you, dear listener, for downloading this. You can break out your choice. Be sure to star heart favorite up. That's how people find out about this show and SudokuPad. And then follow us on Mastodon because that's where we're there. And then join us over in our Discord, patreon.com/shoptalkshow. And Chris, you got anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.